Ready for another day of Anicca? Let's see how it goes. I don't know, I promise Anicca, then I start talking about something completely random, don't I? There's Anicca in that as well, by the way. See, what are we doing there? There's a particular effect that we're looking for. And we are adjusting the causes until we can achieve that effect. That is exactly what's going on. In fact, that is what you do all the time. All the time. You're always turning up or down the dials. Just as it's done over there. Turning up the dials, turning them down. Life is that game of turning things up and down until you hit the sweet spot. But then the thing is, the sweet spot is different for each and every one of you. That's why life seems so difficult. And that's why living with somebody else seems even more difficult. Because their sweet spot may not be the same as yours. And then again, that sweet spot is different for many things. The sweet spot for you when it comes to taste can be different to the sweet spot for you when it comes to your choice of holiday. Or maybe where you want to go tonight for dinner. Or maybe where you want to, what movie you want to watch. So many choices in life, aren't there? There are so many choices you have to make. And when you have to make it alone, it's hard enough. But then some of you decide that we want to make life a little bit more challenging. And then you find a companion, so you can make choices together. It's all right, I've been there, done that, so I know what it's like. And then after a while, a few pets come along, and then it makes it even more challenging, trying to find that sweet spot that ticks the boat and ticks it for all of you. And so, of course, life is a challenge. What we need to understand is how it is a phenomenon, the principle of anicca, that is working out all the time. Then we have no regrets, we have no worries, we have no fears, nothing bothers us. Because we can simply understand the world through the lens of anicca. This will make sense to you more and more as we progress further in the Dhamma. And that's what we're here for. I hope you've done your homework as well. Good, I see a few nods. I see a few people going like this. I see people going like this. Alright, let's see where we can get to today. So before we do that then, we all have an important thing to do. Let us bring our palms in veneration of the Holy One, the infinitely merciful One, the incomparable One, the unparalleled One. He is unparalleled in every way, incomparable in every single way. Compassion, loving kindness, mercy, generosity, you name it. He is the perfect one, the fully awakened one, the Supreme Buddha. He is our teacher, our master, and our guide. And in his footsteps, we strive to tread until we achieve the same bliss as he did many thousands of years ago. The path lay clear for all of us, so we can all traverse it and achieve the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. That is our resolve, that is our determination, and that is our purpose of coming here today. So with that in mind, let us take a moment to seek refuge of the Noble Triple Gem, observe the precepts, and get along with today's proceedings.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
The purpose of these talks, ladies and gentlemen, is to help you redefine your philosophy for life. It's just that. Because your philosophy for life determines your outcome for life. Your life is a process, start to end. There was a start somewhere. We all know what that date was. It's going to end someday. We just don't know what that date is. But it's an expiry date that we don't know of. Some of you may never find that out. Well, you know, it's possible. Sometimes, you know, you just go into a coma and you don't even know what's going on. And then one fine day, that's it. All you know is you're in the next place, wherever that place might be. And you don't even know that the inevitable has already happened. So this is the process. But out of life we must get something. Shouldn't have done that. We all try and get something out of life. You know, when you get, when you buy, say, a box of chocolates, there's an outcome you expect from that. You want to have your chocolates, and sometimes, you know, after you've eaten all the chocolate, you even lick your fingers because you want to get every bit of the chocolate. Right? You paid for it, you want it. When you buy a bun or a burger, right, you will eat your burger, and when no one's watching, what do? You lick your fingers, because it's finger licking good, isn't it? When you buy a tub of toothpaste, normally in a regular house, what do? We still do it at the monastery. After we've used up all of the toothpaste, what do? Or are you too posh for that? What do? You cut it open, yes, and then you take all the whatever is left inside, you put the stick, the toothbrush in there, and you get it all out, don't you? We still do that at the monastery. Heck, I learned that growing up. I still do that at the monastery. I mean, even if I didn't do it in my lay life, I would do it as a monk, because, you know, it's not my money. So I am duty bound to make use of every bit that our generous devotees, you know, this is not money that grows on trees. People work hard to earn their money. And then they have to make their accounts. They have to make sure that they have enough for themselves. They have to make sure there's enough to feed their families, to send their children to school. They have to make sure they have enough to treat their ailing mother. Right? And after all that is done, then they have enough. They set aside some for charity as well. Some people do it the other way around. They start off with charity. And that is a habit that was that we had as Sihelas. We started with charity because we realized that it is only what we give out in charity we actually get back in return. Our ancestors knew this. So the first part of whatever they earned, they set aside towards whatever their faith was, whether it's the church, the mosque, the kovil, the god, right, their deity, whoever it was. And of course, in our country, our forefathers, they set aside the first and foremost part of whatever they got, whatever something valuable they got, towards the Buddha Sasana. Right from the kings, it was a habit that we picked up. It was part of our culture. So in any case, when you get a tub of toothpaste, you get every bit of it. You want to make use of every bit of it. Even if you've paid for it, you know what I'm talking about, because you've paid for it and now you want to make use of it. See, sometimes we do that with things like toothpaste. We do that with chocolate spread. We do it with our cheese. We do it with our bread. We do it with our whatevers. But we don't sometimes even think about it with our lives. You know, when your toothpaste runs out, you just need to nip to the shop. However much a tub of toothpaste is these days, right? And you buy one. But when your life is done, how do you go and buy another lease of life? You can't just run to the corner shop and buy some, can you? Life doesn't come like that. Sometimes, you know, the very precious things in life we seem to be so relaxed about, so lackadaisical about, until you understand the value of life. So the purpose of these talks, ladies and gentlemen, is to help you fine-tune your philosophy for life. If you've understood the purpose of your lives, then my job here is done. Let's take a moment to think about how you used to live your lives. Maybe it's beginning to change now. And I think it is. Because, you know, each Sunday you come along, I share with you something which I hope makes an impact on you, which I hope has an influence on you, which I hope helps you to make some of the choices that you make in life, and to ensure that you make choices that you don't later regret. But let's just go back maybe a few weeks, a few months before we started these get-togethers. And maybe if these stories don't relate to you, think about some of the other people who still live such lives and see what outcome they want to get out of life. Take a typical mother, for instance. Right? So she wakes up early in the morning. In most homes, the mother is the first person to wake up. Most homes. Not every home, but most homes. Is that so in your case? Is mother the first person to wake up? Some are like, what does he know? It's alright. So in most homes, mother is the first person to wake up. And then she goes and puts the kettle on. And then she has to cook the rice, make something for breakfast. And a cup of tea first goes to the daddy. Wake up, honey. Get ready for work. I've polished your shoes. I've ironed your clothes. It's all ready. Some homes. Other homes it can be different. Some homes it's the other way around. The father wakes up. He goes and puts the kettle on. And then sometimes they take turns. But in a typical home, let's say a typical Sri Lankan home, usually the mother wakes up first thing in the morning. She's usually the last person to go to bed and the first person to wake up. It certainly was the case in my home. So like, you know, being a mother was in some ways a punishment. Especially if you have children, then you just double the punishment, triple the punishment, quadruple the punishment. You know, mothers are a glutton for punishment, aren't they? They just enjoy that so much. We all had a mother, so we all know what that feels like. So a typical mother, she wakes up early in the morning and puts the kettle on, prepares something for breakfast, gets everyone else up at home, and then she has to make sure that everyone's ready to leave. Because we have, you know, they've all got to leave on time. And usually waking up the children is not something that can be done once. Right? If you have one child, you wake them up how many times? For each child, how many wake-up calls? Yeah, the younger they are, the more difficult it is. Sometimes not so either. Sometimes, you know, people never change. You know, growing up is just a number. Some people's attitudes never change. Right? If they're not happy to wake up, then they just don't change at all. But usually, about two or three times per child, and then if you have three children at home, that times three, so you have about six times waking up. And the husband has to be woken up as well. Yeah? You know the dream. Okay. So then after that, pack lunch, get everyone ready, and then send everyone off. Now in our typical homes, the mother used to stay at home. But things are very different now, of course. Because more needs, more wants, you know, life is a lot more complicated than it used to be. So mothers don't even have the privilege of being at home now, nowadays. Those days it used to be that the father was the hunter-gatherer. So he went out, he earned for the family. And the mother earned for the family as well. She earned for the family by saving up. Like she made sure that the leftovers were saved up for another day. She made sure that, you know, they had something grown at home. Maybe she had a little garden at home. She grew a few things, a few vegetables, maybe some fruits. So that those things didn't need to be bought from the grocery. And so perhaps in some homes they had cows at home and she used to milk the cows and all that. You know, all those things used to happen back in the day. This is all back in the day. So we are taking a trip back in time, on a time capsule. It may never happen again in the future. May never. Because the world is moving at such a rapid rate. You know, I think in the near future, we will have everyone going out to work. And, you know, you'll probably have children who will be doing education in the morning, and then they'll be doing a job later in the evening. Maybe after 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, children as young as 16, 15, 14 even might be going out doing work, earning something for the family because life is getting very complicated. And because there are very few, you know, resources are very scarce, resources are limited, but people's wants and needs are never limited. Mind you, their needs are limited, but their wants are not. That's right, isn't it? Your needs are limited. You have only the basic needs, just the same needs that I have. But people's wants are unlimited. So to keep up with your wants, you have to earn the means to provide them. And that is what's going on out there. People used to live very simple lives. If you in fact remember, maybe recall your grandparents, talking to them, and them sharing some of the stories of how they used to manage their domestic lives, you know, I'm sure Siya must have said many stories of how he would, you know, spend the evening with Achiamma, sharing little stories. Your parents even. I think your generation is not old enough to have had parents or grandparents who had lost, you know, this part of our culture. But your parents may perhaps would have shared stories with you, how they would sit down with their parents and listen to stories. Stories of the Buddha. Stories of the great Arahant, stories of the old kings. But let me ask you this. Do you have the time to share those stories with your own children? People seldom do these days. But you don't need to do that now because you have the television that does it on your behalf. Am I right? You have Facebook that does it on your behalf. You just have to get the child in front of an internet connection and they will learn everything they need to learn about the world. Just not the things you want to teach them. They'll be learning what Mark Zuckerberg wants to teach them. Or someone else out there wants to teach them. That may not necessarily be what you want to teach them. You know, what a mother and a father want to give their children, it's hard to imagine that anybody else in this world wants to give them. You know, it's so, these words are unfortunately so true, but it's ugly, it's the truth nonetheless. People are after whatever they can get out of you. You know, we think slavery was abolished long time ago, but it wasn't really. It is now, in modern days, slavery is just taking another form. If you actually just think about it, ladies and gentlemen, people who speak to you over media, people who speak to you over the internet, people who speak to you over your televisions at home, they get you to work, earn money, and then transfer that to them. And in exchange, they give you something that is not actually as valuable as the money you give them. Because otherwise, they, you know, that transaction wouldn't take place. They have to make a profit out of it. To make a profit, I have to sell you something for the same as I bought it, or for less than, or more than I bought it. To make a profit, I've got to sell you something for more than I bought it, right? So I'm always selling you something that is more valuable than what you're willing to give me. So I beg your pardon, the other way around. You're always giving me something more than what the product or the service is worth. But that's okay, that's how business works. I've got no qualms about that. But what I'm saying is, although we believe that slavery was abolished a long time ago, it wasn't. This is just slavery in another form. And therefore, wants keep on growing. People keep on feeding these messages into your heads that you've got to do this, you've got to be that, you've got to be this person, and therefore they determine the outcome of your lives. In fact, I bet you this, a few months, if you carry on listening to these talks and practicing the Dhamma, not just listening to the talks, but actually practicing the Dhamma, reflecting on the truth behind the words that I share with you, in a few months' time, you'll be going home and you'll be looking at the things you have around you, the things that you have been accumulating at home, the things you've been hoarding at home, and you're beginning to wonder, why the heck did I buy this in the first place? You are. You're going to begin to question some of the choices that you made in your lives. Some of the places that you went to, some of the things that you did, you're going to question them. You're going to ask yourself, why? Why did I actually do them? When I now realize that they were not really sources of happiness, I just did it because someone else thought I should do it. It's going to happen. And I hope it does. Because then you realize that today I am very different to who I was yesterday. And then you realize the transformation that has happened within you. I'm sharing with you the journey that I took and the transformation that happened within me. You know, this transformation, it didn't happen overnight. Because if it did, it wouldn't last long. Agreed? If this transformation happened overnight, it wouldn't last very long. This was a very calculated decision. Analyzed, balanced, checked, all that was done to ensure that this was the right choice that I was making back then. But way before that, I began to question some of the choices that I had made in my life. Modern day slavery is going on, unbeknown to you, but it's happening. That is why sometimes I remind you, don't be fooled to think that you are making your own choices, because most of the choices that you make are actually choices that have been made on your behalf. Like going into the shop and you see 3 or 4 or 5, maybe at most, different brands of soap, bread, whatever it might be, and you think you have choice, but actually those choices have already been made. Sometimes the same brands come from the same companies. But they make you feel like you have choice. But wait, right before you went into the store, right, the adverts were played on TV, you saw the billboards, it was on the radio, it was on the internet, the pop-ups always came up, right? So your lives are being decided by somebody else. What they don't know is their lives are being decided by somebody else as well. It's a dog-eat-dog world, really. Now, none of this is meant to make you feel miserable. What a miserable life this is. Oh no, no, it's not meant to be that. This is meant to help you awaken. This is meant to help you make the right choices in life, choices that you know will lead to the outcome that you want. I often ask this from people when I speak to them. What point is there in a life in which you are born crying and then die crying? What would be the meaning of a life lived like that? It would be pitiful, wouldn't it? We were all born crying. There's nothing we could have done to help that. Nothing. You agree? There was nothing we could have done about that. We were all born crying. The fact that we were born implies that there was nothing we could do about it. But none of us have to die crying. None of us. But the truth is, what percentage of people who die actually die crying? Almost 100%. Almost. A very small proportion of people actually die with a smile on their faces. A genuine smile. Not a smile because they want the people around them to be happy. And in case they think that I'm unhappy, then they might also shed a tear. Not that kind of smile. You know, that's just, you know, bearing it up, like trying to man up. That's not what I mean. Genuinely, if you can smile, when you leave this world, that would be a life that would have been worthwhile. So how do we get there, ladies and gentlemen? It's one thing to talk about it. It's easy for me to say this, but how do we actually get there? Particularly when you have all these obligations and duties and responsibilities that you have to address, and there are so many things around you that determine your state of mind. Can't you make a list of all the things that determine your mood? Like the mood lights? Your mood changes all the time, doesn't it? Just take one day, for instance. Like that mother who wakes up in the morning. Right, she wakes up hopeful that she's going to have a good day. But then she realizes it's not. Right? Maybe the hot water is not working. There you have a problem. Maybe there are bills that haven't been paid. Then you have a problem. The children are not feeling well, so they can't be going to school today, so they have to stay at home. Two of them are staying at home, one's going to school. Again, you have a problem. These are not problems you can walk out of now, because those problems you are going to have to live with for the rest of your lives. I can't change that, but what I can change is your state of mind, so that no matter what your circumstances are, there's always a better outcome. There's always a better outcome. See, there's a very simple formula, which is very simple, but it's very powerful at the same time. Can you all see that? What do you see on the board? E times R equals, that's not zero by the way, that's O. E times R equals O. Unlikely I can help you change these things. The E's. Unlikely. For the E's to change, a lot has to change. But because these two, because the O is the outcome or the product of these two things, you don't have to touch this. You can simply change this and get a different outcome. So now you know what the O is. It's the outcome. If this is not easy to be changed, what do you think the E is? It's the event, absolutely. And the R? Your response. Now answer this question for me as honestly as you possibly can. The majority of people out there, of course they want a different outcome. Every single day they are expecting a different outcome. Because this outcome is universal for all of us. It's universal, there's no question about that. That outcome, in one word, is it not? If we were to summarize the outcome for all of us in one word, it would be that, wouldn't it? Happiness. We just want to be happy. That's why we do everything we do. But tell me, most people in the world out there, which of these two factors do they typically try to alter, change to get to this outcome? The event. The event is the external stuff. Most people are so busy trying to change the events that take place out there. But there are a myriad of events out there. There's a plethora of events out there. The events are infinite in number. And the more people and the more things that are connected to your lives, the more events there are that take place. What do I mean by these events? Pretty much anything. You wake up, so we come back to the mother who wakes up at 4 o'clock in the morning. She thinks she's woken up at 4, but the alarm hasn't gone off. And actually now she's woken up at 5:30. So that was the rooster that woke her up, not the alarm. And then she realized, good God, it's 5:30. She had to have been woken up by 4, but now it's 5:30. Now the event has changed. This is an event. We've all been there when the alarm didn't go off. Right? In that moment, if you don't have the right response, there is nothing you can do now to change the event. You can now curse up there. You can curse the people around you. See, this is what people's typical response is. Because they feel that they're a victim of their circumstances. And these events are the circumstances. So when does one feel they're a victim of their circumstances? When they are not smart about their response. I don't believe anything in life is a curse. I believe every event in life is an opportunity if you are able to see it that way. I've never been the glass is half empty kind of person. Thanks to my teachers and my mentors, they've always taught me to look at the glass being half full. And that positive attitude to life has really gotten me very far in many places. And even in my monkhood, my teachers today, my mentors today, they continue to show me that the glass is always half full. What that means is, let's not point the finger out there and try to sometimes change things which cannot be changed. If I can change my response to it, then I can get a different outcome. See, this outcome mainly are two. One is happiness, the other is grief, sorrow, sadness. These are the two things that your life balances on, right? You're either tilting one way or you're tilting the other. You're constantly trying to tilt your life in one way. And that way is happiness. This is a constant battle. You know this stuff. If you just take one example from this morning, right before you walked in here, when you got up this morning, there would have been plenty of things which tested you. Life is all but a test. It's a constant test. The test of, do you have the right response to life? And if you fail the test every single time, your outcome is going to be sadness, grief, sorrow. If you get the right response in life, then every single time, your outcome is going to be happiness. It's possible. I'm talking about mental happiness, by the way. This hurts me just as much as it hurts you. Right? So physical pain applies the same for all of us. I'm not talking about the physical pain. We don't even need to worry about that because, you know, physical pain is only going to be with you until you have a physical body. At the end of that, that's done. You needn't worry about physical pain. Now, it is, people spend far too much time concerning themselves about physical pain when in fact the bigger problem is the mental pain which amplifies and magnifies that physical pain. I've told you, I think I shared this with you last week as well, and I've been sharing. Whenever I get to speak to, and you know, if there's an elderly audience particularly, or maybe there are those who are physically unwell, there are some who come to us and they are terminally ill, for instance. I tell them, I can't change any of the physical aspects. You're ill, I can't change that. But much of the pain you're experiencing right now is actually psychological. This is mental. That we can deal with. But it's always best to deal with it before it happens. Just as they say, prevention is better than cure, physically, the same applies mentally as well. Prevention is better than cure. So before the problems come, it's better to understand the Dhamma. And there's a reason for that, folks. One key ingredient that you need to understand the Dhamma is joy. A peaceful state of mind. You need to be, you know, not over the moon, But you just need to be okay. You need to be okay with things. You need to, you know, just like what you are now, right? Just right now. You know, it's not like you are, you know, on feeling on seventh heaven. You're not on cloud nine, but you're okay, right? You're happy. You're okay. That peace, that state of mind, that joy is an essential component of understanding the Dhamma. This is what we call the prasada chitta. That prasada is necessary to understand the Dhamma. See, that is what is lost when something happens in life, an unfortunate event happens in life, and then you are thrown into grief. So, when there's someone who's grieving over their dead mother or their father, for instance, you know, and they're shedding tears, and you know, they just can't think of anything. They can't come to a peaceful state of mind. It's very difficult to preach to them at that time. Even if you're hungry, it's difficult to preach to you. Simple as. You'll have heard of stories where the Buddha received some people who came to listen to the Dhamma, and the Buddha said, please have him fed first, and then bring him back, and I will preach to him. Because when there's a lot of physical discomfort going on, your focus is always on that. You can't help that. Now, if you're hungry, if you hadn't had breakfast this morning, if you're hungry right now, when I start preaching to you, from time to time, your tummy is going to start rumbling, and that's going to distract you. It's going to keep drawing your attention towards that. So your samadhi is not going to build. See, to understand the Dhamma, you need to develop your samadhi step by step. I don't mean jhanas. You don't need to get into the first, second, third jhana or so on. But you need to have a certain level of samadhi. And samadhi is where the mind lines up with the Dhamma. It becomes harmonious with the Dhamma. It begins to resonate with the Dhamma. That is samadhi. So that state of samadhi is essential. So therefore, you must have taken good rest last night. So if you have a sermon in the morning, then don't be staying up too late if you can help it. But if you start falling asleep, if you start feeling tired, then the effect of this sermon is not going to be on you as much as it would be if you were fresh and awake and alert. All of these things are essential. So from time to time, it's important that we discuss some of these things as well. And when you know, in the morning, don't take a heavy meal. Because what happens if you take too heavy a meal? Then it's time to doze off after that, right? So don't take a heavy meal in the morning. I'm just talking about Sunday mornings. Any other morning, you can do whatever you like. But Sunday mornings, don't take too heavy a meal. You just don't have to be here for a couple of hours, and after that, you know, you get refreshments as well. So don't stay up too late on Saturday night. Don't take a heavy meal on Sunday morning. And come here fresh, so you can be alert, because this is the time that you invest on yourself. All other times are invested on other things and other projects and other purposes and so on. This is a philosophy of life, or this is a formula that helps you to work out the right philosophy for life. A lot of people out there, ladies and gentlemen, they're always concerned about the event. Their response never changes. Have you not seen some people who say, you know, I'm just an angry person. I get angry very easily. I get worked up so easily. That's just my way, you know. So let's just make sure that, you know, things are done as I want them, because otherwise I just get angry. I'm the angry one. Like the Buddha is the compassionate one, the merciful one. At home you may have the angry one. Do you have them at home? The angry ones? Give me a virtual nod. Don't give me a real nod. Just a virtual one. That's fine. Thank you. There's the angry one. Sometimes for some people that is part of their pride. I'm the angry one at home. Don't anyone be messing about with me. I'm the angry one. They make it part of their identity. Sometimes it becomes such a part of their identity, it becomes almost impossible to get them to come out of it. Because that defines them. I mean, it's a real menace then. See, how do you save someone when they don't want to be saved? It's like, how do you wake someone up if they're not really asleep, but they're faking it? Ever tried that? When someone's faking, they're not really asleep. How do you wake someone up like that? Wake up. No response. Wake up. No response. Why no response? Because they're awake, but they're pretending to be asleep. How do you wake them up? You can't. You just can't. Someone who's really asleep, you can wake them up. But nothing in this world can wake someone up who doesn't want to be woken up. So never let your, you know, it's okay that you are angry, you get angry from time to time. It's perfectly fine. And that's why we come here. Yeah, we have problems. We all have problems. We all have problems we want to deal with. We want to sort ourselves out. That's why we're here. Right? So like you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, this is Raga Dvesha Moha Anonymous. We are here to sort ourselves out. And that's perfectly fine. I don't expect a room full of saints. Because a temple is not a museum for saints. It's not. It's a hospital for sinners. That's what it is. So this is our temple every Sunday morning, isn't it? You come here, you worship the Buddha, you worship the Dhamma, you worship the Sangha. So where the Dhamma, the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha are there, that is the temple. So this is our temple on a Sunday morning. So I don't expect here to be a room full of saints. In fact, I expect a room full of sinners. Are you sinners? Hold on. I'll look away. Now answer. He who has not sinned may cast the first stone. All right, go on then. See, none of us can do that. So that's okay. That is why you're here. You know desire gets the better of you. You know there are times when you don't, you know you shouldn't be doing it, you know you don't want to do it, but it's, you're just driven. It's like you get possessed. You know that, and that's why you're here. You know you get angry, and that's why you're here. It's okay. You know you feel egotistical towards things. Sometimes you feel like, you know, I'm the big one, I'm the better one, I'm the what do you call it, the Lord. And sometimes you feel so little, you feel so small, you feel like everyone else is better than me. You know, I'm so insignificant. Everyone else is just better than me. Everyone else is smarter than me. Everyone else is cleverer than me. Everyone is more studious than me. Everyone else is more intelligent than me. I'm just nothing. I'm just nobody. Why do I even have to live in this world? Why don't I just off with myself? Sometimes we have people like that. If there's someone in the room who's got AIDS, are they okay to be here? What do you think? Yes. There's someone in the room who's gay. Is that all right? Absolutely. There's someone in the room who's a womanizer. Is that okay? Perfectly fine. There's a thief in the room. Are they okay to be here? They're okay to be here. Just watch out your wallet. But they can be here. Absolutely. Because that is what the sasana is for. It's for the thieves. It's for the murderers. It's for the philanderers. It's for the thugs. It's for the drug lords. That's what the sasana is for. Anyone who suffers from raga, dvesha and moha. There's a prostitute in the room. Is that okay? Is it? It's perfectly fine. So what? That's what the sasana is for. This is not a temple for saints. It's not a museum for saints. We are here because we're all sinners. We're trying to work on ourselves so that we don't have to sin again. We're here to cleanse ourselves. We're here to purify ourselves, our mindset, so that we can find ultimate happiness. And all that is needed, ladies and gentlemen, is to ensure you have the right response to problems in life. As I say, I can't help you change the events because your lives are determined by your own circumstances. So if your husband doesn't treat you well, here's what you ought to do. Bring him here and I'll talk to him and I'll somehow try to change him so that he becomes a good husband and treats you well. job done, right? Huh? Is that what you expect out of Sunday morning? No, thank you. Let the husband be. You come along. Let me talk to you. Let me explain to you that these are the circumstances that you have inherited because of your own karma. Plenty of times, you know, sometimes I have people in the room. It's never happened here yet, but I remember one day at the monastery, I was doing a sermon, and this talk of domestic violence came up. I think someone in the audience asked this question. Swami Nosa, what do you have to say about domestic violence? I said, they deserve it. And people are shocked. I think someone's jaw dropped, he hit the floor, I heard the noise. How can a Swaminarayan say like that? You win the lottery, what do I have to say about that? That you deserve. But violence, that you don't deserve. Now I know there may be people in the room who have been victims of that. That's why we're all here. But it's for us to understand that we decided our own circumstances. Maybe not today. Today maybe, you know, you live holy lives, but you know, we've not always been like this. Let's be honest. If you have any faith in some of the things that the Buddha taught about karma and vipaka, right? If you have any belief in that, for long you don't have to, this doesn't have to just be belief, or you don't have to take it at face value. Right? Soon enough, you're going to understand how karma and vipaka are actually real phenomena. Right now, it might be just because you read it in a book somewhere, or Swami Mahansa says, you know, karma and vipaka is what determines, you know, the events in your life. But you don't always have to believe just because I say so. Soon enough, you're going to understand the science behind it, and then the light bulb will just go on. I get it now. It will happen. Whatever you get, that is what you deserve. Buddhist teaching is to help us understand that we need to have the right response to that. And the right response includes being equanimous about whatever comes our way. You know, the eight vicissitudes of life. There's loss and there's gain. There's fame. And there's, what do you have, the opposite of that? Defamation. Yeah. Then there's praise and there's insult. Yeah, you have both sides of this. And the Buddha's teaching is to help you to stomach it all, to accept it all in the same way. And see, all that is about response. How do we have the right kind of response so that no matter what happens around us, it doesn't impact our happiness? So this is not a plus, it's a product. So even if this goes up 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, 1,000,000, 1,000,000,000, all you got to do is have the right response. Make this a zero and the answer is a zero. It matters not what the outcome, it matters not what the events are in your life. Now, the reason I'm asking you to think about this, ladies and gentlemen, is because I want you to question from yourselves, have you subscribed now to this philosophy? If not, I need you to do it as soon as possible. Have you subscribed to this philosophy, the philosophy of let's leave the events as they are, let's take ownership of our outcomes, let's take ownership of our own lives, and the outcome of our own lives, and start with making changes to the response rather than the events? Have you subscribed to that idea yet? Or do you still feel, yes, Swami Nansa, I get the Dhamma, I listen to the Dhamma, but when I get home, I want my husband to be nice to me, I want my children to be kind to me, I want my dog to be obedient to me, I want my boss to be thankful to me, I want my neighbors to be understanding of me, right? Again, you go back home and you go back to your normal, regular, routine ways. Let's not let that happen. Otherwise, my efforts would be in vain. all that trekking from Ingiriya to Rajagiriya will be in vain if you don't start changing your response to things. The Noble Eightfold Path is simply a different response to the same events. That is what the Noble Eightfold Path is. Samma Ditti is first understanding this. That's it. See, I can break it down into very simple language for you. What is the Noble Eightfold Path? Changing your response to the same events that take place out there. That is the Noble Eightfold Path. Because it is the Noble Eightfold Path that gives you the outcome of happiness. Samma Ditti is understanding this, recognizing this, and accepting this as your new philosophy. Samma Sankappa is organizing your thoughts so that you face these events in the right manner. Now, an untrained mind, their thoughts are going to be raga, vihinsa. So, vyapada, vihinsa, and karma. These are their thoughts. Karma sankalpana, vyapada sankalpana, and vihinsa sankalpana. This is miccha sankalpa. So, what is karma sankalpana? So, karma is not necessarily the three-letter word that ends in an X. That's not that. Although most people think that when you hear the word karma, it only represents sex. That's not what it is. In fact, the word karma has a lot of depth and a lot of profoundness. Ultimately, you will begin to realize that your sense of self is also based in karma. But because we've learned a lot about we've heard this word karma, we feel that it is to do with sensual gratification, especially the fifth sense. Not so. In fact, the word karma, if you study the etymology, these words, they have a reason why they have come together. That is why karma is called karma. The word karma actually means whatever you do that goes against Nibbana, that is karma. So karma sankalpana is where you indulge with sight, sound, smell, taste, touch in the hope of getting the outcome of happiness. That is karma. Vihinsa sankalpana, I'm just going over them briefly, we'll discuss them later, you know, on another day. Vihinsa sankalpana is where for the purpose of happiness, you are willing to do things that may inflict, that will cause hurt to others. It's not necessarily done out of anger or hatred, but nonetheless, it is done out of not necessarily resentment either, but you know, these are scornful remarks, for instance. Sometimes even when you crack jokes. If you actually, you know, begin to go through this with a fine-tooth comb, you'll begin to realize why you haven't attained Nibbana yet. If you go through it with a fine-tooth comb, actually. I'll give you a very simple example, right? Take Charlie Chaplin. You all know Charlie Chaplin? Yes, the world-famous comedian. When you watch Charlie Chaplin, right, he's walking along the road and he slips on a banana peel and he falls. What is the reaction that comes out of you? Huh? We laugh, don't we? That takes you a step away from Nibbana. Ho, ho, ho. Because you see, you are rejoicing in someone's pain. Vihinsa. That is joy, a sense of joy that you sense in an unfortunate event that someone else has had to endure. I'm not talking about, you know, of course, Charlie's acting there. Yes, we understand that. He knows he's acting. We know he's acting. We both know what they're doing there. But in that moment, you know, say someone's climbing up a tree or someone's climbing up a ladder and their sarong falls. What happens? What is our reaction? We laugh. But actually, if you think about it from their perspective, Now they're not acting. This is actually just an unfortunate incident, right? From their perspective, it's, you know, they feel very embarrassed, don't they? They feel victimized. They feel really bad. So when we laugh about that, it's not the reaction that they want from us. But you can't help it, because that is how we've been trained. In someone else's grief, in someone else's misery, our reaction is to laugh at it. Now, I'm not saying from here on, don't watch comedy. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, this is why Nibbana seems so difficult for us. Because each of these things is a step away from Nibbana. That is what vihinsa sankalpana is. But you would never go hurt someone. You'd never do that. You'd never pull by the sarong. You know, you would never do that. But when the sarong falls, you laugh at it. If you went and pulled the sarong, that's vyapada sankalpana. So you're the one actually inflicting the hurt. You're the one actually inflicting the pain. You don't do that. We are good enough and decent enough not to do that. But if someone slips and has a fall, someone bangs their head on something, you know, stupid, look at what they're doing. So, you know, someone behaves like an idiot. And these things, generally, you know, we laugh at them. This is all vihinsa sankalpana. In fact, as a monk, it is forbidden for us to laugh at things like that. Now, you've got to wonder why the Buddha laid down such rules of conduct. If someone falls here and you see me laughing at it, what impression are you going to get about the Swami Nansi? See, someone has a fall. Right? And I go, how is that going to make you feel about Swami Nansi? He's heartless, you might think. He can't relate to the person at all. He's in grief, he's suffering, and you're laughing at it? But we show it on TV and people laugh. See how TV has made it okay for us to sin in secret. The TV, the internet, you know, if you were out there, ladies and gentlemen, and someone, you know, say a woman dressed scantily was walking along, you know that any decent person should not be looking at that. You can't be ogling her. That you look away, at least out of common decency. But capture that on video camera, stick it on the internet. Now, who's there to police you? No one. See what the TV and the internet has enabled us to do? We can now sin and no one's watching. So we can sin in secret. We don't know that these things are happening to us. But unfortunately, it is what it is. I'm not against television. Technology is good. If not for the television, you know, how would we get these talks to other people? How would they watch them? You'd have to be here every Sunday, and from across the oceans, you'd have to get this far. But now, because people have a television screen, because people have the internet, they can listen to these talks right from the comfort of their own homes. But people don't always use it for that. I don't think the television was invented to spread the Dhamma. Do you? Do you think the internet was invented so that we could preach to the whole world? Do you? No. Did you know that more than 80% of the internet traffic are two things? One, yes, what is it? Pornography. And the other, gambling. If these two industries were to collapse, you wouldn't be able to afford your internet bills. I tell you. So, thankfully, there's plenty of pornography and there's plenty of gambling going on so that your internet bills are affordable. How much do you have to pay to get a fiber connection? Fiber. You're connected to the world at the speed of light. I mean, it should cost you an arm and a leg, shouldn't it? But what, for 5,000 rupees, 7,000 rupees, 10,000 rupees, something like that, you can get yourself a decent connection. Why? Because much of the cost is footed by those industries, pornography and gambling. It's what keeps the world going. So if they were to shut down, then life as we know it would be very difficult. So therefore, The organizations and the powers that be ensure that they thrive forever and ever and ever, so that people can exist and live happily. See, this is the thing. As I always say, I'm not here to change the whole world. It wouldn't be right for me to go and say, stop pornography. Let's all fight against pornography and, you know, draw the line, pull the cord, cut it, stop it, seize it. No. Because the world we know it would change so fundamentally that in fact living would become almost impossible. If you were to stop gambling, life as we know it would change so much, it would become very difficult for you to even afford some of the basic necessities. It pays the taxes. Otherwise your tax bill is going to go, you know, shoot through the roof. But thanks to tobacco, thanks to alcohol, right, you're paying at a level of tax. I know you're not happy about paying your taxes. Are you? You ought to be. You ought to be. We all ought to be happy about paying our taxes. You know, if you're going to have to pay it anyway, might as well do it happily. Mightn't we? Because it's an expense at the end of the day anyway. At least if you can make that, you know, put that part aside. What, say 5% of your earnings is your tax, 10%, 20%, 25%, whatever. Whenever you pay your tax, it matters not who uses it and for what. If that is the tax that you have to pay, I don't know why I'm talking about this. I was going to talk about anicca. But these are things that we need, you know, for life. Right? Otherwise, we come here, we practice, we listen to the Dhamma, but we go back home and you have the tax bill to pay and you're like, you start swearing at everyone. You know, right from the kings to the last peasants. You start swearing at everyone driving around. You say, I pay my taxes, but nobody's doing the roads. You know, the potholes on the roads, the lights are not mended. And you start complaining. If you had to build the roads by yourself without paying taxes, do you know that it would be impossible? You know, that is what we do. The tax system, I'm not talking about whether, you know, they swindle money, you know, whether they use money for whatever, you know, things. That's not what I'm saying. It's our duty for each and every one of us to pay our taxes. When you pay your tax, if you have to pay your tax anyway, do it happily. Because at least that way, you're contributing to your nation. You're contributing to the success of your nation. You're contributing to everyone's comfort, and do it happily. You will earn some merits out of it. Whereas if you're paying your taxes and you're not doing it happily, I'm not saying you have to, you know, pay more than you should. Of course, you know, you needn't do that. But whatever fair share of taxes you have to pay, do that happily. Because if you're going to have to do it anyway, you might as do it. You might as well do it happily. Because what happens if you do it unhappily? We are back here. Don't be so cheap that you resent paying taxes. That's such a cheap attitude to have. Never be like that. The successful people in this life, in this world, you know, they don't have regrets about paying taxes. They're happy about that. Because they contribute. They have a sense of joy, a sense of pride that I have contributed towards the development of my country. It might be that the tax money that is collected is used in many wrong ways. But, you know, that's not for you to worry about. Because you're going to have to pay it anyway. So you might as well do it happily. How did we get into taxes? How did that come about? It's one of those inevitable things in life, right? No matter what conversation you have, it always ends back in taxes and politics. Let's come back, trace our steps back. As I was saying, anyone with any problem is welcome here. Anyone from any walk of life is welcome here. I know that in our audience, we have people who are not of the Buddhist faith. We have people who are of different religions, and that's perfectly fine. There are some in the audience who come up and say, Swami Nansa, I can only come every other week. Because every other week I have to go to the church. I'll come every other week. Is that okay? I said, no, perfectly fine. Because as a good Christian, As a good Catholic, I have to go to the church and I have to fulfill my duties to the church. Absolutely. Don't you agree? Yes. You must. If you are a Muslim and you are expected at the mosque, you have to go and fulfill your duties. Fulfill your duties. Fulfilling our duties is not an optional part of life. That's not optional. Fulfilling our duties and responsibilities are a mandatory part of our lives. If we are here, if we are born into this earth, right, and God has been so kind as to give us this life, by God I mean Vipaka, but you can interpret it in any way you want. If we have been fortunate enough to be born, then it is our duty and our responsibility to fulfill our duties to the fullest, so that you don't have any regrets. You know, I'd hate for you to be the person who goes to bed at night worrying that the tax collectors might come knocking on your door. Why live in fear? It's not worth it. For a few thousand rupees? It's not worth it. I mean, look at how much you spend in the name of happiness. Excuse me. You bought yourself that new car. You bought it, now I think someone told me that the tax regulations are going to be changing soon enough. Maybe that's why we are talking about tax. I just realized. Someone said the tax regulations are going to be changing and everyone's going to have a tax profile or something like that. Right? And if you own land and if you have a vehicle, something like that, you have to have a tax file. So I think paying taxes is going to become an integral part of everyone's life. I don't earn anything, so I'm free of tax. So I don't have to maintain a tax file. I have no land to my name. I don't have a cent to my name because everything I had, I sold all that to buy the property on which the monastery is built today, and even that land doesn't belong to me. It is bought and it was offered to the Buddha Sasana. We have a charity trust at the monastery. It's not mine. None of it is mine because I haven't come into this world to collect and gather and accumulate and, you know, and call my value by the things that I own. Today I sleep peacefully. Do you? I sleep very peacefully, ladies and gentlemen. Any price is worth paying for that. To have a peaceful night's rest. I have no fear. I live in no fear. I have no debts. I don't live in fear. You know, I don't walk around every corner wondering if the debt collector is behind me. I don't. Now you'll say that's because you're a Swami. How can we as lay people? Yes, I understand. That's why I'm inviting you. If you want an outcome in life that you're happy with, right? If you want the desired outcome in life, then it is only your response that you can change. Yes, you can't all become monks, and it wouldn't be, you know, it would be unreasonable to expect that you'll all become monks one day. It's not right. But one day you will. Maybe not in this birth. Maybe not in the next birth. Maybe not in 300 births. But maybe the one after that. We are all destined for Nibbana. But you don't have to become monks to attain Nibbana either. You can do that quite well in your lay lives as well. As long as you keep your mind at the right response. Your response is what determines your outcome. Because we can't go changing the events, because these rocks that keep falling on our heads were chucked in the air way before. And now we just have to face the consequences. If you throw a stone up in the air, is there any force that can stop it from falling onto the earth? There isn't. So if you are stood under it, it's going to fall on your head. You can change your response by not being there. So therefore, it's not going to fall on your head. The Buddha's teaching was that. There are things in life we've done, even in this birth. I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, right? Let's say there's one person in the room who's always been a saint there throughout their lives. And who's that person? That person is you. I'm talking about everybody else. All right? Everyone else in this room, if we take a walk back in our lives, there are plenty of things we've done. Today, we regret them. Today, we're not happy about them. We're not proud of them. Those were our weakest moments. Those are the moments in life that we are shameful of. In fact, we don't even talk about it with other people. There are secrets in our lives. I'm sure there are. Secrets that no one knows but you do. No one knows. But your conscience knows. I did this. Nobody else knows. And today you suffer because of that. The teaching can help you free yourself even from that. All you got to understand is the Dhamma, because the Dhamma helps you to come out of yourself. Excuse me. And it is for that purpose, as this is what I said right at the beginning of this talk, we are here to help you redefine the philosophy for your life. That is why we've all come here together. Get the right attitude for life, get the right philosophy for life, have the right response to life, and no matter what those events are, your past events may sometimes come back and haunt you. That's okay. It's not the reminder that is bothering you. It's your response right now. Say when you were younger, right? Maybe say, okay, not younger, maybe 5 years ago. You cheated on someone, on your partner. Let's say, your wife, your husband, your partner, your girlfriend, your boyfriend. You cheated on them 5 years ago. And today you are reminded of it. My task is not to stop your memory or erase your memory. So I'm not going to electrocute you. I'm not going to take, you know, out your memories from your memory bank and somehow try and make you forget that. I'm not going to hypnotize you and say, like, go back to 5 years. Right? That event never happened. Right? Come back. Now, you're in the present moment. Did that event happen? No. It's not about that. I'm trying to help you to be okay with whatever has happened in your lives. But those events will come back to you, ladies and gentlemen. They may come back to you. So if you've cheated on someone, then someone might cheat on you. It's tit for tat. The karma world is such. What you give, you get. If you've caused someone grief, if you've caused someone agony, then chances are you're going to have to face that. But the Buddha's teaching helps us to purify our minds so that mentally you don't have to suffer. Physically, I can't help it. Can we cut a deal there? I can't help you to be free from your physical pains. If you've hit someone, you're probably going to get hit. Probably. But mentally, if you've starved someone, you're probably going to have many days of starvation. The Bodhisattva, right, in the last 6 years before his becoming a Buddha, you've got to wonder, right? Someone as meritorious as the Bodhisattva, who's, you know, this is his final birth, for all the perfections that he would have fulfilled by that point. Remember, when he was offered that, the panikam, sweet cakes, there's a story in the Buddha's life. He was offered a cake, and behind him was the great elder Kashyapa, Mahakashyapa. Right? And then there was an old lady who offered a sweet cake to the Buddha. And then this lady, she waited, and then right after the Buddha walked past, who came along? The Kashyapa Thera came along. Because the two of them are very similar in their image, the lady mistook the Buddha for Venerable Kashyapa. And then she realized, I actually had offered my cake, not to the person I wanted to, but to somebody else. Who's that somebody else now? The Buddha. She wanted to offer it to the Venerable Kashyapa Thera. This was actually one of the reasons why the Venerable Kashyapa Thera ultimately decided that he was going to take himself away from civilization and live in a jungle, away from everyone, because he realized that people mistook him for the Buddha, and offerings that were intended for the Buddha were made to him. And he didn't want that. You know, just think about the greatness. He didn't want that. Because this is his teacher. Right? Everything he's earned in his life is because of his teacher, and he didn't want that. So when that cake was offered to the Buddha, the lady, she went back to the Buddha. By that point, the Buddha had walked a few steps, and she went running back to the Buddha and said, "Oh, whoa, whoa, hold on. Can I have my cake back, please?" Just imagine that. I mean, poor us, we don't even have a chance to offer anything to the Buddha. But here's a lady who's actually had the chance to offer something to the Buddha, and she does what? She goes back to it to reclaim it. She said, hold on, Buddha. No, actually, she didn't know that it was a Buddha. But she said, can I have that cake back, please? Now, at that point, the Buddha had lots of other offerings in his alms bowl as well, in addition to the cake. And the Buddha, out of pure compassion, made a determination so that the lady wouldn't see any of the other food in the alms bowl and just the cake. Because if she'd taken any of the other part of the offering, then she would have taken something that belongs to the Buddha. And that would have not been very, very good for her. So she ended up taking the cake. And now the Buddha, in this moment, had a moment of contemplation. He wondered, why is this so? He asked himself, you know, I am the supremely enlightened one. There's no one who has made as many givings as I have. I've shed blood, sweat and tears. I've given arms and limbs. I've given my whole life to become a Buddha. Why is it that I have not deserved this cake? See, you don't get what you don't deserve. Then tell me about domestic violence. See, even the Buddha doesn't deserve what he's not given. That is what he realized at that moment. Not realized, but he of course he knew it. But on reflection, he realized that for all the people that he had given food and whatever, to this lady, in the last 91 kalpas, he's not given anything. So therefore, she has no debt to pay. They have no debt between the two of them. So therefore, he's not deserving of that cake. And so he shares his story with the Venerable Kashyapa. I didn't get it because I don't deserve it. I was not meant to receive that cake, and that is why it was taken back from me. See, this gives us a good lesson. So, of course, then she went and offered this to the Venerable Kashyapa Thera, who realized, you know, what had happened. And he didn't want it to be that way. Because how much more merits would the lady have earned if the Buddha had taken it, right? But unfortunately, she didn't have the chance to do that. So this is why the Venerable Kashyapa, he left his... So it's like it's almost like he renunciated twice. Once leaving his lay life, and then secondly, leaving the community of the Sangha. He took the Buddha's permission, and then he went away and lived in isolation for the rest of his life. So if you read the Kashyapa Thera story, there will be a point where he left, you know, just general civilization, and he went and isolated himself in a forest because of this event. Because the two of them are very similar in image, in their looks. So what you don't deserve, you don't get. Therefore, whatever you get then is what you deserve. So the only rocks that fall on your head are the rocks that you threw up into the air. Nothing else. If you've thrown flowers into the air, then what falls on your head will be the flowers. If you've thrown stones into the air, then what falls on your head will be the stones. So from time to time, you will feel flowers falling on your head, and you'll also feel stones falling on your head. The flowers will make you feel happy, the stones will hurt you. That is because of your response. If you have a solid response, ladies and gentlemen, if you can be equanimous towards whatever event that comes to you, then your happiness will be unshakable. That is what we're trying to get to. But as you rightly said, the majority of people out there, I would even say 99.9% of people out there, when they feel unhappy, when they feel fear, when they feel sorrow, when they feel grief, what they try and do is they go try and change the event. And here's the last piece of that puzzle. In changing the event, they actually do even more karma. That is why it's a vicious cycle. What created that event in the first place? The karma, right? It is the karma that created that event in the first place. Let's take an example. Someone borrows some money from somebody, okay, with intention to pay it back. But things turn out in ways that they don't expect, and they lose their job. Things are, you know, the economy falls and life becomes very difficult for them. Now the person who they are in debt to, they come and ask for the money. Can I have my money back, please? Yeah, please give me a few more days, I'll pay it back. You might have been on the receiving end of this. Like, there might have been times where you've lent money to people. I've done this. And you keep asking them, there comes a point where you just have to cut your losses and forget it. I think most of you must have this experience. But I hope you've not been on the other side of the equation, where you're the one who borrowed the money but never paid it back. If so, go and pay it back now. You can leave now. Permission granted. Go and pay it back now. Because otherwise these are debts that we will have to pay someday, ladies and gentlemen. And when the cows come back home, oh, it's going to be painful. But you might have been on the receiving end of this. So anyway, in this example, in this story, this person, the person who you are in debt to, comes back and asks you, can I have my money back, please? The person says, can I give me a few more days? Things are not going very well, but I'm sure I'll go and find the money. Okay, I'll give you another week. They come back in 1.5 weeks' time. Money, please? Where's my money? I'll get it to you. I'm just trying to, you know, make some transactions, just trying to, you know, that business hasn't gone through as I expected it. The contract didn't get signed as I expected it. My customers haven't paid me yet, but I'll get you the money as soon as, so please give me a few more days. Come on, man. How many times are you going to keep excusing yourself? Where's my money? No, please, I beg you. All right. I'll give you 3 more days. Please have the money ready. So 3 days later, the man comes again. Now he's asking for the money. This time round, he comes with another person. Big mate, well built. You know what the drill is. Right? You know where this is leading. Can I have my money, please? Sumane, talk to him. Where's the money? Sorry, I still haven't been able to. Right, now here's the deal, right? I've given you enough extensions. I need the money. Either give me the money, or I'm going to get it from you. Do I look menacing? I'm just acting. I'm not normally like this. Either give me the money, or you'll be sorry that you didn't. By the way, how's your daughter? She's only 12, isn't she? Would be such a shame if something were to happen to her, right? I'll come back tomorrow for the money. Have it ready. Give my regards to your daughter. And he walks away. You must have at least seen this in Bollywood. Yeah? So, now you have 24 hours to either save your money or to save your daughter. What do you do? So Sumane, who came with the person coming to collect your debt, he just, you know, just by chance, you know, raised his t-shirt and you saw that there was a pistol in his pocket as well. He just, you know, just happened by chance. He just displayed his pistol to you. And now you're really worrying that something might happen to your daughter. And 6 hours later, you also get a phone call. Tomorrow I'm coming. By the way, is your daughter? Where is she now? She okay? Just give her my regards. Anyway, maybe you should be spending the last few hours you have with your daughter happily. You know where this is going now. You know, you all seem like, you know, this is like fantasies, but these things happen every day. This is real life for some people. This is reality for some people. Don't you believe me? That is why whenever I have a chance, I go in an arms round at least to give them a chance to get out of this shocking samsara, to this hell of a place of samsara. When you permit me to go an arms round. But you, Lord, don't do that either. But this is a reality for most people. And for you, you know, life is okay, life is good because of your merits. But a lot of people out there, you know, they live in utter fear. Debt collectors come in knocking on their door saying, I'm going to kick you out of your house. I need you out by tomorrow. People come in threatening to kidnap their children, threatening to take their lives. For some people, you know, this is just the normal life for them. And you wonder why some, you know, people live like thugs. Why people start doing drugs. Because, you know, when so much pressure builds up in a mind, I mean, a mind is a mind, isn't it? If you're a doctor and your mother dies, what do? You cry. If you're a beggar and your mother dies, what do? You cry. If you're a rocket scientist and your mother dies, what do? You cry. And if you're a 6-year-old and your mother dies, what do? You cry. So you see, a mind is a mind is a mind. It matters not how educated you are. It matters not how much wealth you have. It matters not whether you're a king or a peasant. When suffering comes, the mind suffers. That's it. So now tell me, what choice does this man have? If he's not an upasaka, he never goes to the temple, doesn't believe in the Dhamma, doesn't believe in Nibbana, doesn't believe in karma vipaka, but he loves his daughter dearly, then, and he can't find the money either, there's only one outcome that he can see. Before they get their hands on my daughter, I have to do what? That's what I have to do. Before they get their hands on my daughter, I have to do away with him. That is the response. This happens all the time. This is maybe an extreme case, but these things and similar things happen. What they don't realize is they're now committing another karma. So if they do something like that, you see, it matters not why you do the karma. If you kill, right, if you steal, if you lie, and the intention is to lie, the intention is to steal, the intention is to kill or to lie or to steal, whatever, right? It matters not how difficult your circumstances are. You can't apply for extenuating circumstances. You can do it for your exams, but you can't do that in the book of karma and vipaka. You can't say, well, life is really difficult. That is why I stole. Life seems unfair, but that is the truth. How poor must you be so that thieving is justified? How poor can you be so that theft is okay? How poor? How terminally ill must you be so that, or your mother should be, so that if you can't afford the medicines that you have to give her to treat her, or at least to extend her life and, you know, make the last few years of her life livable, how terminally ill must she be so that if you can't afford it, you can go and steal the drugs from the pharmacy and give it to her? At what point does it become reasonable? Does it? Not at all. Giving her the medicines is a meritorious deed, but thieving is an unmeritorious deed. See, unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, in the world of karma and vipaka, the two don't balance each other out. This is not an equation. So doing more ping doesn't balance out the pao. It doesn't work like that. Each event is its own. So whatever merits you've done will reap as merits, as rewards. Whatever unmeritorious deeds you've done, whatever demerit you've done, will manifest, will come back to you as consequences. The two of them don't balance each other out. But then there is a saying, isn't there? Upanda sitta. Yes? Karapu pau natha. Varak vendot kalani. So what about that then? People believe that if they go to the Kalani temple and you worship just once, all the unmeritorious deeds that you've done right from your birth, he's washed away. But the Buddha's teaching does not agree with that. Now, how do we reconcile this? Which one do we accept? Which one? No, they're both right. They're both right. The Buddha was right, of course, and he's unquestionably right. But so is the saying, Upandasita karapupavunata varakvendot kalaniye. It is also right. Only we haven't understood it properly. They're not referring to you taking yourself to the Kalani temple and worshipping. Kalani there is Kalyanamitra. Association with the Kalyanamitra, association with a noble friend, helps you to understand the Dhamma. Once you've understood the Dhamma, you begin to disintegrate the karma kosha. In other words, if you are freed from the four great hells, then all of the unmeritorious deeds that you would have done to bring you birth in the four great hells are washed away for good, aren't they? See? Upandasita karapu pavunata varakvendut kalani. Yes. But this is not this worship. It's not just a worship. It's not just a physical worship. Here, worship means you become a noble one by association with a noble one. If you can do that, then yes, that saying is true. So that is why we associate the Mahasangha. That is why we associate with the Dhamma. That is why we associate with the Buddha. The Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, the Noble Triple Gem, what they help us do is to become Kalyana. Cleanse ourselves. All the while, we learn to change our responses so that our outcome is affected as a result. You see, so this is why we are here, to try and understand the Dhamma, to take a different attitude in our lives, to take a different approach in our lives, to change the response in our lives so that we can get the outcome that we deserve every single time. If this is a zero, no matter what value you put in here, the outcome is always a zero. It's the same way. So if your response is always good, it matters not what the event is. Your outcome will always be good. There is nothing you can do to anger, to aggravate an arahant, is there? Because their response is fixed. It's always nekkamma sankalpana, avyapada sankalpana, and avihinsa sankalpana, samma sankalpana. Always. How so? Because it is based in sammaditti. So use these talks to get to sammaditti, so that you can also be like that. Right, let's check your homework then. And you thought I'd forget that. Have you all done your homework? We talked about what last week? Yes, the present continuous tense. Remember? Yes. So why am I talking about this now? To help you to come to the right response. That is why. If your response is nekkamma sankalpana, avyapada sankalpana and avihinsa sankalpana, then that is the Noble Eightfold Path. Remember, by response I mean the Noble Eightfold Path, nothing more. Just the Noble Eightfold Path. The Noble Eightfold Path never leads you to suffering. It always leads you to happiness. Excuse me. But the Noble Eightfold Path starts where? At Sammaditti. Sammaditti is right view. Right view is all I can give you. I can't give you anything else. Honestly, I can't give you anything else. It's not because I'm stingy. It's not like I've got a lot more but I don't want to give it to you. No, Sammaditti is all I can give you. It is what my teachers have given me. I can't give you anything more than that. The rest of it has to happen within you. Sammaditti is all I can give you. So let's get into a little bit of Sammaditti before we conclude for today. Last week we talked about living being. The point I was trying to make was, that these are things that are happening right now as we speak. So there are no done things, they're all things that are happening right now. Remember, let's take one or two examples, and I have a video that I want to show to you as well. So I asked you to think about a few things, maybe a handful of things. I think I'm going to have to live with it for the rest of my life. What I give is what I get. What can I do? This is my vipaka. I have to accept it gracefully. But that doesn't mean I don't try and treat it. And many of you have been very kind to suggest and also offer medicinal things to help with that. So I've got plenty now. You don't need to bring any more. Thank you. You're so kind. You know, whenever you see someone in pain, I mean, if you see someone suffering, you want to do whatever you can. But so I'm okay for now, but I think this is going to be there for a while. But the sermons can't stop. Unfortunately, the best medicine is to stop speaking. That's what the doctors say. Stop speaking for a few weeks and you'll be fine, they say. But if I do that, then how can I give you some adipti? Or write it on a piece of paper and pass it to me. Maybe print a tube and give it to you. It doesn't work like that. It has to come through your ears. It has to be the spoken word. It cannot be the written word. Because I have to engage with you. This has to be a live transaction. That is why your presence here is very important. Not for me, but for yourselves. That is why I want you to be engaged in our conversation. You know, be alert, be attentive, and try and get the most out of this. And, you know, a lot of you are making good progress. I can see that. Well, the very fact that you bring yourselves here every Sunday morning, in the first 2 weeks, understandable because it's new, your friends want you to come along. Right? The next few weeks, you got a free sandwich. Makes sense. Come on, Swami. Master, don't stoop us to that lower level. But by now, you can't be coming here for the sandwiches. I don't think so. You're coming here for panacea, aren't you? You're coming here for the elixir of the Dhamma. Right. So, a few examples. Let's take a car. I'm not a very good artist, so please don't hold that against me. Right. This is a car. Is it a car? It's carring, isn't it? No, I'm not writing caring. It's carring. Meaning? In every moment, the causes are manifesting a car. So this car didn't come out of the manufacturing plant. It didn't come out of the production line. What came out then was that. What it is now is what it is now. These causes are manifesting. Manifesting, not manifested. It's happening right now. So if I ask you to touch the car, which part of the car would you touch? Well, actually, I ask you to touch the car. Go and touch the car. Virtually. Yeah, I know. I'm not asking you to come up here. But if I ask you to touch the car, where would you put your finger? Here? Can you see from the back? Do you want me to draw it bigger? Now everybody knows I'm a bad artist. Right, so let's touch the car. Where would you touch? I want you to put your finger where the car is. What is that? That is the wheel. But the task was to touch the car. Okay? What's that? That's the door. It's not the car. What's that? That's the roof. It's not the car. What's that? That's the boot. Oh, does it look like the bonnet? Don't stop embarrassing me. I know you're doing it deliberately. Stop it.
Oh yeah, it does look like Varanasi. Fine.
Okay, that's the real. I have saved myself. Okay, right. So that's the bonnet. Okay, then how about this? That's the light. That's the grill. So which part is the car? Here's what we'll do. Now what's this again? It's the wheel, right? It's not the car, is it? It's the wheel, right? Well, all we need is a car. We don't want the wheel, we just want a car. Let's take it out. I mean, why do we bother with wheels? We want a car, don't we? Let's take out the wheelie because it's not the car. Right. Let's try and find where the car is now. How about... I still have to keep the arch. Right. How about this? That was a light. Is it the car? It's not the car. Well, all we need is a car to get from A to B. We don't need lights. So let's take the light out. This one, well, one wheel was accounted for. Then we know the drill is the same with the other wheel. So let's take that out as well. We don't need the wheel, right? Because we only need the car. Where do you think we are going to get with this? The way we are going, where are we going to end up? There's going to be nothing left. Yeah? So in trying to find the car, you're going to take out everything else and then you're going to be left with nothing. So where is the car then? Let's put those parts back together again. Now do you see the car? Can you touch the car? You can't touch the car. But you're telling me there is a car. So are cars untouchable? Okay, if it can't be touched, at least look at the car. Just look at the car. Where are you looking? Where are you looking? You're looking at the wheel. So can you look at the car then? Can you touch the... So you can't touch the car, you can't look at the car. Shall we try and lick the car? Can you smell the car? So in summary then, can your five senses, individually, can your five senses sense the car? Can it? No, because no matter what you use your five senses for, you are not perceiving the car. You're only touching individual parts and none of them are the car. Because if it were, you could walk away with that. You don't need the other parts of it. So is there no car here then? Would it be right for us to say that there is no car? Because you see, here are the two ends of the spectrum. It's probably that. This is one end of the spectrum, and here's the other end of the spectrum. On one end of the spectrum, you have what they call Atta. Or actually, what they call Atma. Means there is. There is. There is a car. Is there a car? If there is a car, touch it. And you say you can't do that. On the other end of the spectrum, you have Anatma. Anatma. There is no car. Is there no car then? So then won't you use this machinery, this piece of equipment to travel? You would, wouldn't you? So would it be right to ask for one of these two answers? In fact, if you phrased a question expecting one of these two to be the answer, what do you have to say about that question? I'll say that again. That question itself, I don't think you got it. Let's try that question again. If you were to phrase a question to which the expected answer is either one of these two, what do you have to say about that question? It's the wrong question. Let me give you an example of a wrong question. Is there a car? Because you have only two answers to that. Yes or no.
See, although we think this world is binary, it's a lot more than that. But we seem to think of the world as yeses and nos, ones and zeros. No wonder technology is so advanced, because the whole world is perceived as ones and zeros. There is or there isn't. Either you're on one end of the spectrum or you're on the other end of the spectrum. This is Atma and Anatma. These were the two philosophies that were there even in the time of the Buddha. Not from the Buddha, but his contemporaries. They were mainly divided into two schools. Mainly two schools. But there were many more splits and categories. But mainly there were two schools. There were the Atmians and the Anatmians. There were those who said that there are things in this world. There are. These things exist. So they talked about existence. Then there were those who said, doesn't exist. So they talked about non-existence. And the Buddha comes along. So the two people, the two categories, you know, these two groups of people, their representatives would go up to the Buddha and ask him, Venerable Sir, you claim to be the Buddha and people say that you are very knowledgeable. People say that you are very wise. So I have a question for you. How about you try and answer that question? And the Buddha says, go on, ask your question. So they say, Venerable Sir, do things exist? And the Buddha says, my dear man, you're asking the wrong question. So he thinks the Buddha is now implying that things don't exist. Because that would be the obvious alternative, right? So then they ask, okay, I get it. So Buddha, things don't exist, right? Things don't exist. And the Buddha again goes, what? You're asking the wrong question. So now they're confused. So then you have people who would carry on this conversation and ask, so are you then suggesting that things don't exist and they don't not exist? See, then you have a quadrilemma. So we are getting there. The first was, things exist. No. Things don't exist. No. Asking the wrong question. So things both exist and not exist? No. Things, are you with me? Alright. See, these are all the variants. Do things exist? If the Buddha says yes, they walk away thinking that this is a world in which there is existence. That is what they're expecting. That is why they're asking the question, do things exist? And the Buddha says, you're asking the wrong question. Then they ask the next question. So things don't exist, right? Don't things exist? So they're expecting the Buddha to say yes to that. And the Buddha says, no, you're asking the wrong question. Then they ask the next question. Okay, so now you know they're on a dilemma. Then they go into a trilemma. Next question. So you're suggesting, Buddha, then that things both exist and don't exist? No, you're asking the wrong question. Now, of course, you have another question you can ask. I get it now. So you're suggesting that things neither exist. No, do they not exist? That. So you're suggesting that they neither exist, nor do they not exist. And the Buddha says, no, I have not said anything of that sort. I have not said anything of that sort is what the Buddha says. See, this is a quadrilemma. Now people are confused. Because they only know of a world where there are ones and zeros. Existence and non-existence and their combinations. These are the four combinations of existence and non-existence. Agreed? So therefore they ask questions of the Buddha, expecting the Buddha to agree with any one of these combinations. And unfortunately the Buddha says, all of these questions are wrong because your understanding is fundamentally flawed. It's a bit like this. I'll try someone in the audience. Is that alright? Any volunteers? Okay, let's try. Sir, do you mind if I ask you a question? Alright. I know you have a son. Do you have a daughter? Okay. So this gentleman, he doesn't have a daughter. Okay? My next question. How old is she? No, no, no. How old is she? And he says he doesn't have a daughter. Answer my question, please. How old is she? Is she 5? Do you see my questions are fundamentally based on a flawed thinking? Any question I ask about a daughter that the gentleman doesn't have is fundamentally flawed, isn't it? So when people think that in this world they have existence and non-existence, all questions they ask in relation to existence and non-existence have to be flawed. They have no base. It's like me asking you about your pet puppy and you don't have one. So I can't ask the gentleman, you know, did your daughter go to school today? He says, no. So didn't she go to school today? He says, no. So did she both go and not go to school today? He says, no. So did she neither go nor not go to school today? He says, so I mean, you've got another thing coming if you don't understand what I'm trying to get to you. I don't have a freaking daughter. So you can't be asking me any of these questions. Do you understand that? Because I am based in flawed thinking and assuming that the gentleman has a daughter, I'm asking these questions. Now, back in the day, there were people who believed in Atma. Now, let's figure out why people believed in that. They were not idiots. They just didn't have samadhi, that's all. Mind you, ladies and gentlemen, people back in those days, in fact, they were far more intelligent than people of today. Far more intelligent. It would be foolish of us to say that, you know, those days people were not very advanced in their thinking. People were not very intelligent. In fact, people were so intelligent that they didn't need the internet to be happy. They didn't need icing on their cakes to be happy. They were quite content. Isn't contentment bliss? Well, in which case, people back in the day, they were very much content. Today, people are not so advanced, in fact. People have no patience, they've lost their virtues, they've lost their values, and therefore today people seek happiness from the outside world. Back then, not so. They were quite happy to be at home, you know, find something to eat, you know, and you know, as long as they had something to put on the plate, right? And the children were fed, the wife was fed, the family was fed, and you know, that's it. Life was very simple. Because they were content. By my yardstick, those people were far more advanced than today's race. Anyhow. So people back then had the time to think. Now you'll ask the question, well, why were they looking for an answer to this question? Why yes and why no? Because they sensed exactly what you're sensing right now. They sensed self. Don't you sense self? You all sense that, right? You all sense yourself. Yeah. But you've now begin to understand it is not part of your body. Even that they understood back then. So in fact, you know, people who engaged in, like the Bodhisattva, before he gave up his austere practice with the five ascetics, right? He was engaged in 6 long years of austere practice, wasn't he? Because there was a teaching at the time that if you free the Atma, as in the self, if you free the self from the body, then you are freed once and for all. But it is the body that inflicts suffering upon you, so therefore one way of getting yourself to free from your own shell, if you like, is to fall out of favor, is to fall out of love with the body. So therefore what they did was they continued to inflict pain on themselves just so that they would fall out of favor with the body. Because right now, you know, one of the main reasons you like to have these bodies with you is because your bodies bring you pleasure. This is pleasurable. You know, when you eat, it's pleasurable. It's your body that takes part in that. Your eyes bring you sights. Your ears bring you sounds. So therefore, you use your bodies for the purpose of pleasure, don't you? Yeah, of course. I mean, there's nothing to debate about that. Your bodies bring you stimuli, which the mind interprets as pleasure. But back then, people realized, well, if my body is the thing that is, if I'm attached to my body, because my body continues to bring me pleasure, then I'm never going to be able to free my soul. That is what they meant by this Atma, the soul. So I want to free my soul. To free my soul, I have to break this bond that I have with my body. And one of the best ways to do that, they thought, was to continue to inflict pain on their bodies. Because of course they thought, the more pain it brings me, the less I'm going to like it. How do families split? More pain? Soon enough, the family splits. So in the same manner, they wanted to get a divorce. From what? From their bodies. And free the Atma. So therefore, they were always on this quest to free the Atma. That is what they were trying to do. But to them, just as much as you feel today, they felt a sense of self. Although today you know this as a sense of self, they thought it was the real deal. They thought that I exist just as much as you do, but now you're beginning to understand that this is not me existing, but rather a perception in the mind that I exist. See, they didn't have that understanding. So therefore, they went up to the Buddha and asked him these questions. Sir, I exist, don't I? Buddha said, wrong question. Oh, so I don't exist, do I? Wrong question. So I both exist and not exist? Is that so? Wrong question. I neither exist nor not exist? Wrong question. Now they're confused. Because what other question can you ask? Now they're stuck. You can't go anywhere. It's a checkmate. The Buddha says, you know, none of these are the right questions to be asking, but I can't see any other combination of it. So this is the quadrilemma that people were stuck in. So ultimately, they were left with no choice but to wait for the Buddha to ask them, or rather, to ask the Buddha, sir, if these are the wrong questions, what question should I ask? That's a very dangerous question to be asking from a Buddha. Honestly. If you ever come across a Buddha, don't let him trick you into asking him that question. If you but get the Buddha to ask you that question, if you ask a Buddha, Venerable Sir, so what question should I be asking you then? He will open his mouth and he will start to speak. And if he does that, you will not be here for very long. So therefore, it's a very dangerous question to be asking of a Buddha. Your time, your days are counted from there on. They had the merits to get the Buddha to prompt them to ask the right question. They were so meritorious. So they said, sir, what is the right question to be asking then? Then the Buddha speaks. He says, you sense yourself, don't you? You go, yep, that's exactly what I've been asking, right, for the last few questions, and you've been saying no, 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 and no. I sense yourself. Buddha says, you're asking the wrong question because you're asking me whether it exists or it doesn't exist. How about you ask me why you sense that it's there? Now he's introducing cause and effect. See? That is his teaching. Hetupalavada. Not Atmavada, not Anatmavada. His teaching is Hetupalavada. The philosophy of cause and effect. See what the Buddha says is? You are asking me about a self, but you are asking the wrong questions. You are asking me, does it exist, does it not exist? Do they both exist, or do they both not exist? Wrong questions. Ask me why you feel that it's there. Why do you sense it? Okay, if you say so, I'll ask that question, says the Brahmin, and he asks the question. So then, sir, why do I feel this Atma? The Buddha says, Bhavapachya Jati. That is his answer. So now this man is happy, because he's finally got the right question to ask. So then he says, got it then. So it's in the Bhava, isn't it? The Bhava exists, right? Buddha says, no, wrong question. So the bhava doesn't exist. No, wrong question. It both exists and doesn't exist. No, wrong question. Neither exists nor not exist. Wrong question. Oh, Buddha, what the heck? You've confused me again. So the Buddha says, ask the right question. What is the right question, Venerable Sir? Ask me the cause of bhava, and I'll explain to you. Venerable Sir, what is the cause of bhava? Upadana paccaya bhava. Ah, got it. So the upadana exists, right? He says again. No. Wrong question. Ah, so it doesn't exist. Wrong question. Both exist and not exist. Wrong question. Hayyo. Or the equivalent of hayyo back then. So again the Buddha says, you are asking the wrong questions. Ask the right question. Sir, what is the right question? What is the cause of upadana? See, every single step of the way, what is he teaching? Cause and effect. Hetupalavada. Because nothing exists, neither do things not exist. All there are manifestations. Now, I don't think you need me to spell out the rest of this conversation, so I'll fast forward this a little bit, and then we get to sankhara. Right, so you have upadana, you have vedana, you have tanha, you have vijnana and so on. Right? So this is the dependent origination process. Most of you will have heard of that. If you haven't, it's alright. Don't worry about it. So we come to sankhara. Sankhara is the second stage of the dependent origination process. So now he's happy with sankhara. So he's asking the same four questions about sankhara. Why is he still asking the same four questions? You might wonder, are they so stupid? Why are they asking the same four questions about sankhara? You'll see why in a moment. Because they haven't gone to the root of the question. They're still at sankhara. When the Buddha answers the next question, there is no reason for them to ask that question again. So he's asking about sankhara now. Venerable Sir, so sankhara exists, right? Because what are they looking for? They're trying to figure out why I exist. And they're trying to place this I in something. Because if I am there, I have to be in something, right? So I must be in sankhara then, if that is what the Buddha says I'm in. So is it in sankhara that I am in? Does sankhara exist? No. Doesn't exist? No. Both exist and not exist? No. Neither exist nor not exist? No. Ayo. So what is it, Venerable Sir? Now the Buddha speaks. Avidya paccaya sankhara. Brahmin, it is because of ignorance you feel that existence is in sankhara. See, the moment the Buddha says this, there is no reason any longer to ask, is it in avijja then? See, there's no ground to ask that question. You can talk about sankhara in that way, you can talk about vijnana, you can talk about nama rupa, you can talk about salayatana, you can talk about bhava, upadana, whatever. But avidya is simply ignorance, isn't it? So, you know, that's like a slap in the face. It's like for someone who keeps asking these questions, to tell them, you're asking me these questions because of your ignorance. Then would it be right for the person to ask, well, is it in ignorance I have the existence? I mean, if you know, they have half a brain cell, people will understand that that is not a valid question to be asking. So therefore, the questioning stops there. Now, one final piece to this. Why does the questioning stop there? To answer that, answer this question for me, please. What is ignorance? Exactly. Ignorance is the ignorance of ignorance. Let me say that again. Ignorance is the ignorance of ignorance. So what is wisdom then? Wisdom is knowledge of ignorance. Once you understand what ignorance is, are you any longer ignorant about ignorance? No. Now you're wise, you're knowledgeable about ignorance. So therefore, now you understand what ignorance is. Once you understand what ignorance is, then you are no longer ignorant. And if you are no longer ignorant, then you can't have ignorance paccha sankara, can you? Because what is ignorance after all? The ignorance of ignorance. So once what ignorance is has been spelled out to you, you're no longer ignorant about ignorance, so therefore ignorance has been explained to you, now you understand ignorance, and therefore avidya paccha sankara cannot happen any longer. Therefore the dependent origination process has now been uprooted. So really, to uproot the dependent origination process, all you got to do is to understand the root of the dependent origination process. As a matter of fact, that the very reason that you sense a self is because it's a process driven, it's a cause driven, it's a cause and effect driven process. For as long as you don't know this, you are ignorant. About what? About ignorance. The moment you realize this, now you are no longer ignorant about ignorant, therefore you are wise about ignorant, and you can now explain why jati happens. So what is jati after all then? The sense of self that you all have. See, this is what they discover. Now in the same manner, you see a car here. Is there a car or is there no car? Is there a car? Wrong question. No car? Wrong question. Both yes and no? Wrong question. Neither yes nor no? Wrong question. So what is the right question to be asking? How does a car manifest? What are the causes that lead to the manifestation of a car? Now you see the causes. See? One cause. Another cause. Another cause. Another cause. Cause, 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 cause. So many causes. In fact, you can't even count them. For something to be cause and effect driven, and for something to be understood as cause and effect driven, do you need to understand all of the causes? That's another really important part to understand. Do you need to understand all of the causes? Do you need to know all of the causes? Do you need to be able to count all the causes to understand that something is cause and effect driven? Do you? No, you just need to understand that it is an effect of causes. You need not understand what all those causes are. You need not understand how many are those causes, how numerous are those causes. You don't need to understand that. You just need to understand that it's all cause and effect driven. So the car then, you need not understand what all the causes are, but we know something. It is carring. In other words, it is the causes that are always present that manifest a car in that present moment in time. I'm going to show you a little video to help you further understand this. And this was shown at the monastery, so if you were there for that sermon, then you will know what I'm talking about. So don't spoil it for everybody else. Ingredients. But I think this will really help the penny drop. I think it's a wonderful video to explain that phenomenon. Let's get it up on. So this is a natural phenomenon. It's called murmuration. So these are birds that fly together. You may have seen them. So as they fly as a flock. But they take various shapes, don't they? In fact, what you're doing right now is trying to spot those shapes. Am I right? And you can't help yourself from doing that. Stop doing that. See how disobedient you are? You can't help yourselves from recognizing those shapes. Now let's see if we can spot any. So as you watch it, I want you to make a mental note of some of the shapes that you see. Okay, you see all sorts of shapes. Some may be shapes of objects, others may be shapes of other animals, whatever. Right? Just make a mental note of them, and I'll ask the audience in a moment what shapes you've seen, and then we'll have a discussion about that. Okay, as you start seeing shapes, you can start calling them out. And I'll jot them down on the board. A whale. Fish. What's that? A dolphin. Turtle.
Thank you.
Dry fish. What? A dolphin. What's that? A dragon. A dove. A cloud.
Thank you.
Madam? Eagle. Right. So now you saw them on screen and you called them out. Now, was there a real eagle in the sky? No. What about a whale? It doesn't even warrant the question, right? None of these were actually up in the sky. But what you saw were these birds, as they flew together, they formed these shapes. Now, here's an interesting question. Do you think they knew they were doing this? Really think about it. Do you think they knew? Do you think they had an agenda? Do you think they all discussed together, they have a manual convention, right? And they come together, sit around the table, and they share their ideas, you know, what are we going to do today? What forms are we going to take today? Right? All jump up together, all get in line. Maybe they rehearse before they get up into the sky. Do you think they do that? No. So you see, none of the components, none of the elements. So the elements in this example were the birds themselves, right? None of the birds knew that they were taking part in these formations, were they? None of them knew that. So then, do they need to know? Do they need to? They don't need to. So when these forms were taken and up in the sky, you and I, because we understand patterns, we see patterns. In fact, we see the presence and absence of things. So when you saw the eagle, you'd have seen the birds and you'd have seen the spaces without the birds. That's how you spotted the shape of the eagle, right? In fact, the reason that you can see this fan right now is you know that some of it is the fan, some of it is not the fan. That is the boundary. Do you agree? So this part is not the fan. So therefore you say this is Swaminarayana's hand and the rest of it is the fan. Because you understand boundaries. Now, that is exactly how you spotted these shapes in the sky. But the birds did not know that they were taking part in it. In fact, they had no intention of doing so. But you spotted them nonetheless. So I ask you then, was a dragon up in the sky? What about a cloud? What about the dolphin? None of them were in the sky. But did they not manifest? They did. So if I ask you the question, dolphin, was it up there? Yes or no? No. Was it not up there? Yes or no? Wrong question. Let's draw that chart again. See? We are back there. Dolphin. Was there a dolphin in the sky? I'm expecting you to say yes. That's why I'm asking the question. And you tell me? Wrong questions on me. Okay, I say, wasn't there a dolphin in the sky? There was no dolphin in the sky, was there? I'm expecting you to say no. And you say again?
Wrong question. Okay.
So, was there a dolphin and was there not a dolphin at the same time?
Again, wrong question. I'm expecting you to say yes to this and you say wrong question.
So, no dolphin and no not dolphin? I don't even know how to phrase that question, but there you go. Neither no, neither yes, neither no. That one. So the answer to all of these would be, you're asking the wrong question. But I still saw the dolphin. So what then would you prompt me to ask you as a suitable question? Exactly. Ask me, you tell me, Swami Mahansa, yes, you saw the dolphin, okay. But there was no dolphin up there. And you can't say there wasn't a dolphin up there because I saw a dolphin. I well and truly saw one. So then the question that you should prompt me to ask you then, if you are my teacher, is ask me how I saw the dolphin. Don't ask me was there one or wasn't there one. Ask me how I saw the dolphin. So then I ask you the question, why or how did I see that dolphin? And now you have an answer. You then start to explain to me, these birds, they fly together. And when they fly together, your mind looks for patterns. And when you spot those patterns, and these patterns are patterns in memory, because I've seen a dolphin before. If I hadn't seen a dolphin, I wouldn't have known, you know, one when I see one, right? So I have seen a dolphin before, and that pattern I project onto this formation. In fact, there are so many animals or so many shapes that you've never seen before. That is why you didn't call out all of them. If we had aliens in this room, they'd be calling out other things that you wouldn't. Because you don't have such patterns in your memories. Because we've never seen them as human beings. So you call out what you know. In fact, if you had a young child in the audience, maybe a very young child who's never seen a whale before, they wouldn't call it out. They wouldn't spot a whale. You wouldn't spot a dolphin, perhaps. So you see, you project these formations that you have in your mind onto the outside world and expect it to be there. That's the problem. When you project what you have in your mind to the outside world, you expect it to be there, not a manifestation. You expect the whole damn thing to be there, not a manifestation. Therefore, once you expect it to be there, now you have expectations on it. You expect it to take a certain way. You expect it to do certain things. See, if it's a, now you said there was a dolphin there. What's a dolphin supposed to do? What is a dolphin supposed to do? Yeah, it's supposed to swim. Right? It's supposed to play. Right? It's supposed to go underwater. It's supposed to do things that a dolphin is supposed to do, right? Are you getting the references I'm trying to make here? This is why your children disappoint you. Because you see your child there. In the same way, You are disappointed. If you think that the dolphin's up there, and now the dolphin that you see doesn't do the things that a dolphin is supposed to do by your count, now you're disappointed. Why is the dolphin not doing what I want the dolphin to do? Take a fish. Now you expect the fish to swim around. But that fish didn't. It was there one moment, then it was gone the next moment. Now what happened to the fish? The fish died. See? In your world, what happened to the fish? It died. It disintegrated and it died. Did it really die? Did the fish really die? Why do you nod your head this way? Because there was no fish. But I saw one. So wasn't there a fish? You can't answer that question either. Because if I'm asking you this question, because I saw a fish. So if you tell me there was no fish, I'm going to think you're silly. How come you didn't see what I saw? We were both looking at the same screen. So if I saw a fish, you should have also seen a fish. But what you understand, I don't understand right now. That is, you understand that a fish was a manifestation. It wasn't a unit. It wasn't a fixed fish. It wasn't an entity. What it was a manifestation of causes. So then I ask you again. That fish that you saw, if I asked you to touch it, which part of the fish would you touch? Like the car. Which part of the fish would you touch? Can you touch the fish? Can you touch the dragon? Can you touch the dolphin? No, you can't, because you understand that there is no dolphin there to touch. But yet, it manifests as a dolphin. Now do you get the idea of what a manifestation is? Then take the car again. This is why I say the car is carring. This dolphin that you saw up there, weren't the birds dolphining? That's what they were doing at that moment. In fact, all of the birds, they were taking their respective positions, but none of them knew what they were doing. They didn't know that they were putting up a display there. But when the dolphin shape manifested, the birds were there in the rightful place. That's all. It's almost random. Almost random. They were just there. They just happened to be there when you saw the dolphin. So now, is it fair for you to expect things that you would expect from a dolphin from that manifestation? Would it? Would it be fair? It would be unfair. And if you did, what would happen to you? If you expected what you would expect from a fish, of the shape that you saw on screen, that was just the birds flying around. If you had the expectations you would have of a fish on that, what would happen to you? You suffer. You have expectations, and those expectations are going to be unfulfilled. You're going to be disappointed. And then, because you understand that this fish doesn't live forever, in your world there's a fish, and you see that fish up there. Now from your past experience you know that the fish dies. Now you live in constant fear. Oh, what if my fish dies? See, you live in fear. And when the fish dies, then what happens to you? You go from fear to grief and sorrow. Tanha jayati soko, tanha jayati bhaya. See, who gave you the permission? Who said it was right for you to project whatever you have in your mind to a manifestation that's out there in the real world? In other words, why do you think this is a fan? It manifests as a fan. That's it. It's not a fixed fan. It's not an entity. So don't you be setting any expectations that you have of a fan on this and expect it to fulfill all your expectations every single time. Because it only manifests in this way for as long as there are causes that manifest this. That's it. The very fact that this manifests in this manner means the causes are in action. The moment the causes cease to exist, the effect ceases to exist the following day. The following day? Then? Immediately. So therefore, this is fanning. It's in the present continuous. This is what Pachupanna means. Prachu is the pratya. Upan is born out of. So born out of causes is what Pachupanna means. It has nothing to do with time. It has no place on the time dimension. The time is a projection of the mind again. When you want to relate discrete events to each other, we project time onto things. That's why you say, I left home this morning, I got into my car, I drove to the school, I got off, I parked my car, and I got off, and I walked up to the room, and I sat down, and I've been listening to the sermon for the last 2.5 hours. Each of these events are very discrete events. They have no connection to each other. But you sense a self. So now you need a story to tell about yourself. Because you have a story to tell about yourself, now what you do is you connect each of these individual events on a string called time, and then you start to say, you know what, I woke up at 4 in the morning, and then I did this, I then did that, I then did that, I then did this, and now I'm doing this, and in another hour's time I'm going to be doing this, and by the way, tomorrow I'm also going to be doing that. Each individual discrete events that are born out of causes. They have no connection to each other. Just like those birds. Those birds have no connection to each other. Could you not take one of the birds out and leave the rest alone? Couldn't you? Of course you can. Can you not add more birds? Of course you can. So what connection do each of the birds have to each other? Nothing. But they fly in formation, you know, they have some biological instinct about them, which gets them all to fly in the same pattern. So when some of the birds start flying in one direction, the others follow suit. When they fly in the opposite direction, the others follow suit. So that is some biological, you know, instinct going on there. That's nothing to do with the birds themselves. I'm talking about the physical bodies of the birds. I'm talking about the physical objects, the birds themselves, the mass. Because it's not the birds' minds that you saw as these shapes, were they? It was the birds' bodies. And the physical bird is what you saw in these shapes. So I'm actually talking about the physical part of it. So going back to the car, lastly, which part of it is the car? Which part of it is not the car? If you're telling me no part of it is the car, then which part of it is not the car? See, you can't answer the question because I'm phrasing it the wrong way. That's why you understand whatever answer you give to this question is flawed. I can stick holes in any answer you give me because I'm asking the wrong question. So I have to ask you the right question then. How does a car manifest? Now you can give me a reasonable answer. Now you'll say, Dante, the reason that a car manifests is there are all these causes that have come together in the right alignment, in the right order. For instance, if this wheel was not here, but rather up here, you're not going to call it a car. I mean, if that was a car, then you walk into a, you know, car spare part shop and you see lots of cars. Yeah, because what do you find in a spare part shop? All the parts. But just because there are parts laid out on the shelves doesn't make them a car. It doesn't make all that a car. So to be a car, to manifest as a car, it's not sufficient for the causes to be there. The causes have to be there in the right places. In other words, they have to be in the right order, in the right alignment, in the right configuration. Now you see a bouquet of flowers here, don't you? This flower arrangement here. Why don't you feel that this flower arrangement is the same as that over there? Are they all part of the same arrangement? Now, that can be construed in two different ways. I don't mean for today's event. For today's event, yes, they have a relation. But if you ignore the fact that we have an event going on here, this is one, that is another, isn't it? But now if you think about, if you go back into the mindset of there's a sermon going on, now they're both part of the same event. Forget the sermon. Now they're discrete events. See how you can connect things and disconnect things just based on your thinking? So if it is your thinking that... Did you get what I meant there? Yes? No? The reason that these two arrangements, these two flower arrangements are connected is because you are looking at this as one event. Yeah? But if this was at home... Now only this is part of this event and that isn't. And if someone said this is the one for the sermon, this we are going to be using for the next event, So that's not part of the sermon. So please draw a curtain around it so that people don't see it. Now that immediately that doesn't become part of the event. So it's all in the mind. The mind makes these connections between each other. Because the mind is always looking to connect things. Because it wants to identify single things. It wants to identify entities. That is why when you are Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana, the mind is not happy with that. The mind wants to connect all these things, and without leaving just them as just aggregates, it connects it and makes it one. That's why you feel I am the one. That's why you feel that way. Who's the one? You're the one, right? And you give it a name, don't you? Yeah, that is your identity. You have created your identity. It does not exist for real. Your identity is a make-believe. But all you are the aggregates. Just different stuff, configured in a different way. Configured in a certain way, that manifests this, that's all. And the same goes here. But those causes have to line up in a certain order. That is when we call them, we give them names. And those names are just conventional names. Those are just conventions. See, put this wheel not here, but if you were to take this wheel, right, and instead of putting it up here, you put it here. Now you call it a spare wheel. And now it all of a sudden becomes part of the car again. Now you call it a spare wheel. But take that wheel out and put it here. I said, no. That's not right. You have to have a wheel either here or here. That is no place for a wheel. That's not a car now. It's some weird thing. It's not a car. See, this is how, although manifestations are all that is there, in our minds, ladies and gentlemen, we create formations. This is what is called abhisankara. That is what abhisankara is. The formations that you create in your own mind. And then the problem is you project them onto the real world and expect them to respond as you wish. Last words for today. We started with your philosophy for life. Events, responses, giving you outcomes. See, now, when you expect that out there are entities, your responses are going to be accordingly. Your responses are going to be, I want those events to be a certain way. So I want the dolphin to swim. You expected the dolphin to swim. I want the turtle to come out of his shell. These are expectations you have because your response is wrong. But all there are outside are really manifestations. So when the manifestations change, the manifestations have no, you know, they have no concern about what your responses are. They don't care what you think. Why would they? They don't have any concern or consideration for what your thoughts are, what your expectations are, what your responses are. They just do what they do. Rupa does what Rupa does. You know Rupa. She does what she does. Vedana does what Vedana does. Sanya does what Sanya does. Sankara and Vijnana do what they do. They don't care. They don't give a damn about what you think about them. So therefore, these manifestations, they manifest. Unfortunately, when you have the wrong response to them, now you keep on setting expectations. When those expectations are fulfilled in some places, you feel happy. That is not happiness, that is pleasure. That is the relief from vexation. That is what we've been talking about for the last few sermons ago. And then when those expectations are unfulfilled, you feel disappointed. And then you feel either fear, you feel grief, you feel sorrow. Isn't this what life has been? Ups and downs of life. Whereas true happiness, if you want that as your outcome, true happiness, unconditional happiness, we come to a very good point there. Unconditional happiness comes from your understanding that this is all conditional. Once you understand that all events are conditional, now your happiness becomes unconditional. If you don't understand that events are conditional, then you expect the events to be unconditional. Now your happiness is conditional. You can work out that riddle in your own time. Right, let's conclude for today then. So that was a step up again from last week. I would encourage you to go back and listen to it one more time if you have the time, that is, of course. But we will continue again from next week. So you see, we are making progress week on week. Do try and bring yourselves here regularly, so that, because it's more productive when I can speak to you and I can see you and look at you in your face, because I understand your responses. I'm also looking for the right response. Right? So when you're looking at me, you go, "What?" I know you didn't get it. So I can go over it again. That's why I'm always scanning the room to see whether you got what I had to say. But if you're nodding your head and go, "I get it, somewhere," then I can, you know, that prompts me to carry on so we can, you know, all progress. But if I see a single face in the room and I look and I see that it's a little bit confused, I go back and give another example, and that's the way it works. Isn't that what you want? This is kind of like a mass class, but I do try and make it as individualized as I possibly can. Right, let's do the merit transfer and bring today's sermon to a close. Okay, so first and foremost then, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasikas and upasikas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and have passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is available today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also take a moment to be grateful and thankful to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. And let us also transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to the friends of the monastery, our devotees, and those who, on behalf of their Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide for the construction of the monastery to those who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who extend their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, cousins, nephews, uncles, aunts, grandparents, our teachers, and anyone and everyone who would have helped us, supported us, and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, and primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to protect and fulfill the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us also transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they all prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have passed away in our names, our loved ones, our forefathers, our ancestors, those who have predeceased us, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts that we do, as well as practice the path comfortably. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to those who have made sacrifices with their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, the members of the armed forces as well as the police force, as well as those who have lost their lives in the war, be they friend or foe. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, blizzards and pandemics, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us, those who would have shared in our griefs and our sorrow. May they all rejoice in these merits. By the power of these merits, may they If any of them have been born in the woeful plains, may they redeem themselves to be born in the blissful plain. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a rahatan vahanse or an arahat peranin vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnen midetna, desha ginnen midetna, moha ginnen midetna, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva. Mamada siyalu loka, siyalu satnvayo. Nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva. Raga gini niveva, desha gini niveva, moha gini niveva, nivan sata ladeva, nivan sata ladeva, nivan sata ladeva. Tunuluvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen silu loka silu sattvayoma nibbana parama sukhen sukhita taravetva. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.